Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Amazon Prime Video UK, the home of the US Open in the UK. That US Open, David Law, who joins me remotely from Solihull. I myself, Catherine Whittaker, am on my sofa in Putney. That US Open, David, is mere weeks away now, and that is still terrifying me to my very core. But I'm also very excited about it. The US Open series is, well, it's underway today. As we record, it is Monday the something of July, the 30th of July. The US Open series, well, I guess it kind of started last week. We're in that weird section of the season. There are a couple of them. We've talked about it a little bit on Tennis Podcasts past, David, about how there are these in-betweeny little patches of the season that don't quite fit into the overall narrative of the tennis season, either on the men's or the women's tours. We've had, you know, events in Atlanta, in Newport on grass, in Atlanta on hard courts. We've also this week got Kitchball happening on clay. We had Hamburg last week happening on clay. It's all... There are plenty of great events in there. I know you in particular, David, are a big fan of UMAG, and we will bring you the results and the talking points from all of these in due course. But just as a sort of overall starting point, it's a weird mishmash portion of the season, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it, mishmash, because of the surface differential and obviously the fact that they're played both sides of the Atlantic and it is this weird, slightly out of kilter little series of clay court tournaments in particular that stand out. And the thing is, they are great tournaments, some of those. You mentioned UMAG. I mean, that's close to my heart because I met my wife there. But I also worked that tournament 20 years ago. The tournament in Gstaad in Switzerland is absolutely stunning. And it's where Roger Federer made his professional debut. And it's up in the mountains. And people who've told me that the one in Sweden, in Borstad, which Fabio Fanini won the other week, is amazing. I never got to go to
the
that.
The Swedish always... Riviera, David, is what they call it.
Exactly.
Gstaad.
There are
dogs everywhere.
Really?
I don't know. Yeah, that's the main thing people tell me about Gstaad. I don't know. It's this sort of lovely little seaside resort in Sweden where there are dogs everywhere. Dogs are allowed everywhere and they come to the tennis and everything. So it's Blimey. That's on my tennis bucket list.
And then you've got Newport, which is kind of it's a tournament on grass after Wimbledon, which does seem a little strange on paper, but it sounds like it's a lovely tournament. And they also do the induction for a couple of nominees for the International Tennis Hall of Fame every year, which this time has been Helena Suková and Michael Stich. And that's a really nice event. So it's all lovely. It's just that people like us, and I think anybody who works in tennis, we're all kind of toast after the run that has gone on leading up to the French Open and Wimbledon. So we probably don't take as much notice of it as perhaps we might normally because, yeah, we're on sofas like you are.
I think it's just quite hard for anything more than the really nerdy tennis fan to engage with, because like, if you look at it as sort of three levels of tennis fan, nerdy tennis fan, following it week in, week out, may or may not be recording podcasts about the tennis that happens week in, week out. And then you've got the pretty into tennis fan that will follow the Masters 1000s and the bigger 500s probably, and certainly will get more into events when they fit into a story arc. For example, the tournament, the US Open series, I think that works as in sort of storytelling terms. The build up to the US Open, I think, you know, that does for the medium level tennis fan put a bit of extra emphasis on them. Obviously the same applies to the clay court events in the lead up to the French Open, etc. But then you've got the tier one tennis fan that really like tennis, but I reckon they must just look at this time of year and go, don't know what's going on there, so I'm just gonna phase it out. And it's great that there's an extra grass court event in Newport, Royal Island. Why on earth is it after Wimbledon?
Yeah, I mean, given the standard of those tournaments that I mentioned, UMAG, Borstad, Stad, also Kitzbühel, you mentioned, that's one. I mean, these tournaments have been going on for decades. It's not like they're newfangled events that have just been slotted in after Wimbledon and before the hard court season. It just, again, we had this in our listeners' questions one last week, and we've been asking all week, if you were tennis commissioner, what would you do? One thing you would want to do is reorganise things so you could pick up that little cluster of events and stick them in the run-up to the French Open, because they are worthy of that.
Yeah, speaking of tennis commissioner, by the way, we've had an almighty response to that, not just from Rosie, who got really into it.
Didn't she?
She really did.
She's been doing photo shoots before actually passing she's not even applied yet and she's doing photo shoots.
She's had a very photogenic weekend with the help of some fillet steak. We had some really cracking replies, and we'll be touching upon that later in the podcast. But first of all, as promised, to bring you up to date with results and happenings, actual tennis, balls being struck, that's happened in the last couple of weeks since we brought you a live podcast on the last day of Wimbledon. In fact, I didn't bring you a live podcast on the last day of Wimbledon, did I? You did, David.
No. Yeah. Well, Charlie and myself.
Yeah. Thank you, Charlie.
Charlie's going to be back next week when I have a holiday.
Charlie is going to be back. So, as I mentioned, ATP Newport, Rhode Island took place on grass. Steve Johnson won his second title of the season, both of them in the States. He beat Ramkumar Ramanathan in the final. David, you got any facts about Ramanathan other than the fact that I'm probably pronouncing his name wrong?
I can tell you it was Steve Johnson's second title of the season, and he also won Houston. Because student math...
You've got the same set of notes that I have.
I say student math. I mean grad math. We've put Matt in charge of organising us this week, and that's why social media has been so rampant, and that's why so many good talking points.
It's going to sound like a really organised podcast, and it's all down to Grad Matt. Yeah, but unfortunately, Grad Matt did not provide us with an entire biography of Ramkumar Ramanathan.
No, so sort your life out, Matt. Not
yeah,
good enough.
Not good enough. In Bastard, the lovely Swedish Riviera tournament with dogs, Fabio Fognini beat Richard Gasquet in the final. It was also his second title of the season, David.
We are facts-centric because he's also now up to number 12 in the ATP race to London. How about that?
Yeah, how about that? How about Fognini to make it to London? What odds would you give me on that just now?
That would be good.
I know you don't really understand odds, so whenever I ask you for odds, it never goes anywhere.
If ever he's going to do it, it's this year because it's a weird year. There is a lot of movement. And the thing with Fognini, he is capable of doing it on any surface. Remember, this is a guy who beat Rafael Nadal from two sets to love down at the US Open. If he could just keep his head sort of straight for a couple of months, it's not impossible.
Yeah, he then trekked on to Gstaad and lost first round to Jürgen Zopp.
Of course he did.
So mixed fortunes for Fabio Fognini. Plus ça change. In UMAG, David, the scene of your meeting your wife many years ago, Marco Jegginato beat Guido Pella in the final.
It's not actually possible to say Marco Jegginato without saying it like that, is it?
It's not. No, No, which is why I did it.
Find yourself doing it.
Yeah, there it is. So that's also his second title of the season, David.
He also won the Hungarian Open.
He also won the Hungarian Open in Budapest.
Plucked that one from the depths of my mind.
Is up to 22 in the rankings. That's significant now. He's not a flash in the pan, completely random reacher of a Grand Slam semi-final. He's the world number 22. He's going to be seeded at the US Open. He's a thing.
10 in the race to London. I mean, that is, you know, that backing it up, you're quite right. That good on him for doing that.
And speaking of trends, he lost his opening match then the next week in Hamburg to Gael Monfils.
Did you lose your next match after beating me?
Well, I don't recall, but almost certainly yes.
Right. The rematch imminent, by the way.
Possibly. Surprise, this is. David is pushing for it.
Yeah, well, I've been having a bit of practice lately.
Right, yeah.
So I'm hopeful. What can I say?
In Bucharest, David, the capital of Romania, Anastasia Sevastova beat Petra Martic in the final. That was her third WTA title for her career. Banished memories of losing Love and Love to Simona Halep in the 2016 final. Now, that's a good fact that Max plucked out there, because I wouldn't have remembered that. But as soon as he reminded me...
Let's just get Grad Matt to read out his own sheet, because that's what we're doing.
Well, like, I would love to... I could just smoothly pretend that I'm plucking all this myself, but I had forgotten about that Love and Love defeat. Imagine, David, losing Love and Love in a final.
That is harsh.
It's just awful. Absolutely awful.
I want to know what happened when Sevastova, and this isn't in the sheet, by the way, Matt. I want to know what happened when Sevastova played Halep next. I mean, you know, imagine what you'd be going through your mind facing a player that you've lost 6-love, 6-love to. Have you ever lost 6-love, 6-love to anybody?
Possibly to my brother.
I've twice lost. I actually ran into, almost literally, when I was going on a little morning run at Wimbledon, I came across this Spanish journalist called Miguel Luengo, who is...
I feel like we've been over the pronunciation of Miguel more than once on past podcasts.
Why did we do that last time? I can't remember.
Miguel Seabra, who was telling us about Portuguese tennis.
Yeah, anyway, it's all journalists. Anyway, this particular Miguel is, and I'm not exaggerating, he is half my size. He comes up to my belly button, and he beat me on clay in Estoril. We played three sets. I think I won one game in three sets. And I've also lost 6-love, 6-love to Carlos Bernardes, the umpire.
Well, both of those, David, sound like thoroughly unedifying experiences for you.
They didn't look great. On paper or in reality.
In Gstaad,
or thinking
David,
about them after the event either.
Which is another event that makes this year, in my mind, even more of a mishmash, because it sounds so similar to Bustad, which is the Swedish Riviera men's event.
Borstad.
No, but I've heard it Bustad.
Well, you've heard wrong from the wrong sources.
So Borstad, but there's no B-O-R, there's no O in there. Or
is there an R in banana? No, there isn't. You know, I'm sorry.
Okay.
That's what it is, okay?
You're absolutely certain?
Let us know, at Tennis Podcast. Are we getting this right or wrong?
Right, okay. Well, anyway, the Swiss one is definitely Gstaad. In fact, I think it's a sort of silent G.
Yes, that, I think that's correct.
And it's in the Swiss mountains, isn't it? And as far as I know, there are no dogs.
Oh, I'm not sure about that. Well, that's where there are cows, aren't there, and Swiss horns that are given to Roger Federer every 10 minutes.
Sure.
But we've got a Swedish listener, Rebecca Hjorth. Remember her from the ATP communications manager who used to work at the tournament in Borstad. So she can tell us. There we are.
Okay. All right. I desperately want to be corrected, because I want the pronunciations of those tournaments to be more different so that I can more easily separate them in my mind.
Fine.
So the WTA event won by Elise Cornet. She beat Mandy Minella in the final, who is one of the pregnancy childbirth comeback players on WTA Tour, which is a bit of a storyline of 2018. And the ATP event was won by title debutant Matteo Berrettini, who beat Roberto Bautista Agut.
I don't think I've ever seen him play.
Hit me with all of your Matteo Berrettini facts now, David.
Oh, dear. He'd never reached an ATP World Tour quarterfinal before, and he didn't drop serve once the whole week. He also won the doubles tournament.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it is in these slightly out of the spotlight periods of the season when you do get these lovely little stories, isn't it?
Well, I agree. And actually, these people can. Do you know the first time I ever saw Stan Wawrinka was playing in the final of the tournament in Gstaad.
Interesting.
And he lost. I think it was 2005, and he lost in the final to Gaston Gaudio, I believe. But you know, what stood out was just the thunder crack of the backhand, and because it was one of those tournaments played in the Alps, it seemed to echo when he hit the ball. But it took him some years to go from that sort of swashbuckling type player that you thought, wow, that's a force of nature, to being anybody that you would consider had got a sort of consistent future at the top.
Speaking of Wawrinka, David, no wild card for him into Toronto. He's going to have to qualify in Toronto.
Is that confirmed? Wow.
I believe so, yeah. I don't know whether they've got any remaining that they could. I've read quite a lot of stuff saying he's going to have to qualify in Toronto.
Murray's got one, hasn't he?
Murray has been given one for Washington, Toronto and Cincinnati. So he's set for his US Open lead-up, however many matches that may involve. We'll find out. That is on our grad mat prepared agenda, by the way. Don't worry. We will be talking about Murray.
Mackenzie McDonald, isn't he?
Mackenzie McDonald.
Kyle Edmund.
Yes. Mackenzie McDonald, a fourth rounder at Wimbledon from absolutely nowhere, whose match against Milos Raonic I covered for Five Live. And it wasn't a career highlight for me, David. It wasn't.
Right.
It wasn't the best sort of 17 hours of my life, or I think it was only about four, but it felt like 17. Anyway.
Well, I think it was over 2 days, wasn't it?
No, it was just the one day. Just a really, really long day.
Right.
And just to mop up other results, David, in Hamburg, Nicolas Basilashvili beat Leo Meyer in the final to win his first ever career singles title. In Atlanta, John Isner reached the final for the eighth time in his career. John Isner has got Atlanta on lockdown, and he beat Ryan Harrison in the final. Harrison, incidentally, who had beaten Britain's Cameron Norrie in the semi-final. So big week for Cameron Norrie.
Some good results all around there, because a great week for Cameron Norrie, incidentally beating Kyrgios along the way, who had to retire mid-match with a hip injury.
And got booed off court.
He?
Yeah, he was booed. Yeah, it's not great,
is it?
That's
not serious, because, I mean, that's an injury that's kept him out for months in the past.
And remember, at this exact period last year, David, on the hard courts, I think he had three consecutive retirements in events.
Mm, yeah, it's
so
depressing.
It's really, yeah.
Ryan Harrison, incidentally, who Isner beat in the final, I think he won four matches from a set down. And then lo and behold, he goes a set up against John Isner and doesn't win. So moral of this tale, Ryan, keep losing the first set. Always works for me.
There are others, aren't there, that do. Heather Watson is one that I think always does well from a set down for some reason. And two other, our final two tour level event results to bring you up to date on. Further evidence for me, as if this point needed hammering home even more geographically, of what a mismatch this part of a season is. We've had a WTA event in Moscow where Olga Danilovich beat Anastasia Potapova in the final. Potapova was a really good junior, wasn't she? I believe, was she the one that beat? She definitely won junior Grand Slam tournaments.
Yes, I thought she got to a Wimbledon final, but
yes.
I can't be sure of that.
Well, she's still only 17, so
what I can be sure of is that both players are 17, and both are. I think it's it says here, the first ever WTA final contested between two players born since the turn of the new millennium.
We've got
Thank
stats.
Goodness for student math.
We've got facts. We've got results. We've got scores. We are. Yeah,
grandstand.
Next
Matt
week we'll just
through.
Publish the document and not bother chatting.
Just not have a podcast.
And finally, David, Nanchang in China. Tell me everything you know about the city of Nanchang. Other than that, it's in China.
There's your silence.
Qiang Wang, yes, coached by Peter McNamara. That is my knowledge of Qiang Wang. She beat Zheng Saisai.
And also the Binghamton Challenger, where Jay Clark won the title. 2 hours 56 minutes.
He's
what a win.
Completed the rite of passage for young British tennis playing men of winning the Binghamton Challenger, because Andy Murray won it 2005, Kyle Edmund won it 2015, and Cam Norrie won it last year. Yeah, last year.
Correct.
Yeah.
That is the one bit of tennis I've seen over the last week or so live.
Tell me about it. First of all, how did you watch it?
A stream. Thank you to Mike Cation, the commentator who does all the Challenger events on the USTA circuit, who tweeted the link. And it's pretty cool, really, that you can just watch all these matches and tournaments being streamed live. And I mean, I have to say the trophy ceremony is quite comical compared to what we sort of used to on the regular tour. And I don't want to diss them. They put on a great event and it's a real sort of community feel. But it's just nobody worries too much about how it looks or how it sounds. They just make a fuss of the winner and let him say a few words. But watching the match itself, or watching the conclusion to the match, I was really impressed with Jay Clark over these last two or three matches. I mean, he beat some decent players. He beat Marcel Granollers in the previous round, I think it was, who's been a top 20 player. Jordan Thompson in the final in a nearly three-hour match. You know, and I have to say, when Clark had break points for 3-2 in the third set and didn't take them, I really thought, well, the typical story here is plucky young British player doesn't end up winning. And Clark, well, he said no to that. And I mean, good for him. That's a really good result.
Yeah, he's ranked 175. He's obviously not going to get direct entry into the US Open, but he will be in qualifying. And, you know, if he's following Cam Norrie's trajectory of last year after winning Binghamton, Cam Norrie went on to qualify and win his first ever Grand Slam match, didn't he? So
yes, and coached by Esteban Carril, who coached Johanna Konta, who just clearly has a really good way about him. Yeah, and I don't know. I don't. It's difficult to judge how good Clark is going to be, because I've only seen him play against ATP level players on grass, and I don't feel as though that is a fair enough assessment against how you'll do on other surfaces, because Cam Norrie, I don't think he's ever probably going to be that good on grass, and yet he looks really good on clay and he looks perfectly good enough on hard courts. So all I can say is Clark looks like a real athlete, and he's obviously got a decent attitude, because you don't win these tournaments without.
On the subject of the Challenger Tour, David, that brings us nicely on to one of the announcements that the ATP have made this week to completely revamp the Challenger Tour. Their mission statement is, quote, to enhance the player pathway and improve visibility of tennis at lower levels, which sounds a little bit sort of difficult to decode, certainly the player pathway thing. But I think I know what they're saying. Basically, main draw sizes will increase from a standardized 32 to 48. So there'll be an annual increase of roughly 2,400 places in challenger level tournaments, which will also mean a roughly $1 million prize money boost throughout the year. It's going to be compulsory for challenger level events to provide accommodation for all main draw players, things like that. And also the improved on-site conditions, better medical services, more physios, more practice courts. Those are a big deal for players playing challenger tours. You know, for a lot of them, that will be the difference between them being able to go and compete and try and get ranking points one week and them not being able to do that. These might sound like sort of luxuries around the edges, but they're really not. This is hand-to-mouth stuff a lot of the time. On the, you know, there are bigger and lesser challenger events. You know, you'll occasionally get these funky weeks where you get really big names entering challenges, but by and large, this is gritty life on the never in tennis terms, isn't it? So these are all for the players involved, this is all pretty big deal stuff. The tournament lengths will be standardised. They'll all run Monday to Sunday, including qualifying, to make it easier for players to plan their schedules in advance and avoid overlaps. And tournaments will be categorised in accordance with the number of points on offer to the champion, as is currently on case with the ATP World Tour Rigi. You know, with World Tour, you have 1,500, 250. So with challenges, it'll be, I think, 125 will be the top and 70 the lowest.
Yeah, which is a good idea.
Absolutely great idea. The one caveat to all of this is part of the reason that they're doing it is from 2020, the Futures Tour, which is the tour below the Challenger level tour, which offers ATP ranking points currently. It's sort of a slightly weird situation where it's operated by the ITF. But offers ATP ranking points. Please see previous week's discussion on the bizarre administrative structure of tennis. The Futures Tour will no longer offer ATP ranking points from 2020. So professional tennis essentially is going to start at challenger level, and they want to hugely cut down the number of professional players, which currently is 14,000, and they want to get it down to about 1,500, so 750 men, 750 women. So that's, I mean, that's
cut,
orders of magnitude.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying take out 90% of the people who class themselves as professionals.
Yeah, I mean that's redundancy. That's making 90% of people redundant.
But these people are not making a living.
No.
Really. I mean, I know there will be people out there. There will be players who play those levels that aren't happy about this. And there are players that will say that their sheer love of the game means that they will keep wanting to slog it out at that level, etc. Maybe this is unfair, but I do tend to look at the challenger level and above, generally speaking. I think I like the changes overall. I just want to be sure that there is a clear enough passage for those that are able to, well, the players can get from juniors to challenger level and from seriously injured back to challenge level and that sort of thing. I don't think there is much to be gained for anybody really just slogging around playing ITF events forever.
No, and I'd love to know, you know, how many players are there that have sort of existed for an entire career just playing futures level? How what is the longest anyone stuck at it? Has anyone sort of endured the entire, you know, up to the age, let's say sort of 33 is an average retirement age, at futures level without ever making the leap up?
I mean, how they make ends meet is difficult to know. I mean, there are other things. There are sort of various league tennis structures in different countries, and obviously they can get private funding, and some people are just independently wealthy and so forth. Generally speaking, that to me is not professional tennis. So making the challenger level tournaments have needed a boost for a long time. So hopefully this will be for the good.
I wonder if the revisions would potentially encourage more players who have been out for a long time with injury to play a few challenger level events here and there, dotted into their schedule, rather than taking... I mean, obviously, they'll still take wild cards into big events. I mean, Nishikori did it, didn't he, quite recently?
Yeah.
Earlier this year, he played a few challenger-level events. I could see Andy Murray doing it.
I'm in favour of it, generally. And I think playing qualifying is a good thing a lot of the time. I've spoken to players quite recently about it and the benefits. So,
Andre Agassi did it, didn't he? I mean, he dropped down almost entirely to challenger level for a good period.
Goran Ivanišević did it too. And I always remember him talking about saying, they don't even give you balls.
Well, now, Goran, they're going to give you accommodation. They're going to give you physios. What else are they going to give you? Practice courts and better medical services. And I've seen Goran serve in the past year. And I reckon he could, you know, win the odd match. Something to consider, Goran, anyway. I bet you, if he's listening to this, which he's definitely not, he's going to go running. He's been waiting for the opportunity to get back on tour.
I think he might be listening. Hi, Goran. Anyway.
Oh, we flatter ourselves.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Moving on to our next pre-prepared talking point, which is, well, two Novak Djokovic related talking points. One of which I find one of which is just nice, which is Djokovic's. It's an open letter he's written, talking very frankly about how the last couple of years have been for him, exactly what the challenges he feels that he's faced over the last couple of years, how vulnerable, that's his word, he's felt over the last couple of years. He says he's still vulnerable and he's not ashamed of it. He said he wasn't being patient with his tennis expectations, wasn't wise in strategizing, and wasn't clearly hearing his body telling him that there was something serious happening with his elbow. He said, I was trying to find solutions somewhere else and the solution was always inside of me. After many changes with training, racket, team members, et cetera, I didn't know if I'd be able to get back on the desired level of tennis. Actually, one part of me always believed in my own qualities and capabilities, but there was a lot of doubtful moments where the course of action could have gone different ways. And then he talks about the sensation of having his son with him at the trophy ceremony in the players' box at Wimbledon, and how wonderful that was. And he signs off by saying, I love you, I love tennis, I love life, Novak. And that brings us on nicely to separate comments that Marijn Vajda, his longtime coach that he split up with for a year or so and then got back together with, made to a Slovakian news agency, Denik Sport, which were publicised on Twitter via Sasha Osmo, who's a Serbian journalist. He spoke very frankly. I think this is the first time anyone's done this. There were rumours that Boris Becker was unhappy with the influence that now famous Pepe Imaz, the peace and love coach that Djokovic has had by his side for much of the last couple of years. There were rumours that Becker wasn't happy with his presence and the team, the influence he was having, but nobody's really spoken out about it. Well, Marijn Vajda has done now, and he said he didn't think Pepe Imaz's influence was a good thing for Djokovic's tennis. He said he wanted the collaboration to stop, which it does now seem to have. He said it wasn't his number one condition, but he did want to talk to Novak about it in person. He said tennis can't be based on philosophy. It's a sport, man versus man. I would add brackets, woman versus woman. If you want to be the best, you do that by repetitions in practice, by matches and by strong mentality. When you see an opponent, you have to focus on where to send the ball, not to think about Buddha, which is an excellent quote, which really solidified in my mind just what an excellent human being Marijn Vajda is. Also in that interview, something he touched upon was and I think it's something that Djokovic is hinting at here in his open statement, the changes that Djokovic made to his diet. Marijn Vajda said that he had moved to an entirely plant-based diet. And although sort of some of the dietary adjustments and so on that Djokovic has made were a good thing, I believe the feeling was that it had gone far too extreme, and Marijn Vajda has encouraged him to bring some protein and some meat back into his diet. So I find that really refreshing that he's spoken so openly about that. And obviously, yeah, he's my new favourite person, David.
Well, I mean, a couple of the immediate takeaways for me. The one that I don't think you mentioned it specifically in the intro to Djokovic's open letter is the one about motivation, where Djokovic very clearly says, "What my other big issue was motivation." And a lot of people around at the time when Djokovic was struggling, and a lot of his fans was when we were saying that he looks as though he's lost his sort of get up and go for the sport. A lot of people saying, "Well, it's just injury." Now, obviously, injury was a big part of it, and I sometimes think there are other people who just gloss over the fact that he was injured when they talk about his come down. It was a combination. I think there was more to it as well, personally, and I think he's slightly alluding to that in some of the words that one day he'll tell the story. But the fact is that motivation did take a dive after he won that French Open, because what else is there to achieve when you've basically won it all in the space of a year? And Pat Cash said to us a couple of weeks ago, it's the greatest tennis year in his opinion there's ever been, for 12 months, that him winning four in a row. Marin Vida, he just calls it as he sees it. And again, Pepe Imaz, we all threw a bit of scorn and on his influence and impact.
Let's be honest, David. I threw a lot of scorn on.
Yeah, well, on yeah, and, but I, and but I don't think you were alone. And I think and at the same time,
whereas you had the Peace and Love T-shirt, didn't you, David?
Well, you know, I think one thing I'm always wary of is just being so strident about something that hasn't played out yet, because sometimes you can be wrong. And I knew what I felt. I felt it was utter nonsense with the way this guy was part of the team, but I thought, well, look, it's Novak Djokovic, he must know what he's doing. You know, that's kind of how I ended up thinking about it, is surely he knows what he's doing. Well, he didn't know what he was doing, and he's admitting it now. He got it wrong. Marin Vida has just magnificently just destroyed every notion that it was a good idea in the first place.
Serena Williams, David, has been not playing tennis this week, but she has. Oh, she's playing in San Jose, though, this week, isn't she? Interesting. Her pre-US Open period could be very interesting indeed. As it stands at the moment, it looks like she's going to play San Jose, Montreal and Cincinnati, which is about the most tennis Serena Williams has played in a solid three-week period since about 1997.
Yeah, and I would say she opens up, incidentally, against Johanna Konta. I think that's tomorrow night as we record on a Monday afternoon. But actually, I think it's about right now.
Yeah, I think it's great, but it is interesting.
She needs to become a serious tennis player again. If she wants to get to where I think she wants to, which is the very top and winning multiple slams again, I don't think she's looking at 25 slams. I mean, you mentioned the chat you've had in the past with Patrick Mouratoglou about how that number is not the ceiling for them. Why should it be? This woman, we saw it at Wimbledon. She's good enough to get back to the very top. But one of the reasons Angelique Kerber beat her so handily is because she was match tough. I mean, look how many matches Kerber's played this year. Aside from playing very, very well, she's played 50, 60 matches. Serena's played about 8 or 10.
Well, and also, sorry, David.
No, just to say, I think now is the time that if she's going to get back to that level, she just needs repetition.
Yeah, and also, and further evidence of that, she doesn't even need to look across the net. I mean, look how much better a player she was in match 7 at Wimbledon to match 1. I mean, she improved almost immeasurably with every single match. And had she had, you know, another 2 weeks' worth of matches, been on match 14 by the time she played Kerber, she certainly would have tested her more, in my mind. Whether she would have won or not is a different story. But yeah, I mean, she has all the evidence she needs that at the moment it's all about playing tennis matches. So I'm so happy to see her in the draw in San Jose, and I'm sure San Jose are quite happy about that too. Johanna Konta, David, not happy.
No. Bit of a bummer, isn't it? But who knows? Maybe
such
it,
an
I mean,
absolute
actually,
bummer. That'll be the first time they've played since Australian Open last year, of course, when we now know Serena was pregnant.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, it was when Konta was at the height of her powers.
She was one of the favourites. Lots of people saying if it weren't for the fact that she was drawn to face Serena in round 4, she, you know, a lot of people would have been picking her for the title.
Yeah, she got a real surprise there. And I think that that was one of Serena Williams' best performances. Mm. It was one of those where she's saying, right, you're the new kid on the block, are you? Right, come on then.
So away from the tennis court, David, Serena Williams she's been doing some social media for a change. I don't know if you've noticed, but tennis players are quite into social media.
Seems to be the case.
So she's picking up on this isn't new. She's talked about this before. She talked about it at Wimbledon, her frustration with the frequency of her drug testing relative to other players. She said on Twitter this week, and it's that time of the day to get, in quotation marks, randomly drug tested and only test Serena. Out of the players, it's been proven I'm the one getting tested the most. Discrimination? I think so. At least I'll be keeping the sport clean. Hashtag stay positive. And then in a subsequent tweet, she said, but I am ready to do whatever it takes to have a clean sport, so bring it on. I'm excited. Which sounds like someone texted her and said, Serena, I get your point and everything, and you're welcome to it, but maybe just take the edge off it a bit and say you're excited about the drug testing. So there's a lot to this, David, and we can't possibly, as much as I would, there's a part of me that would sort of quite like to, I've got things to do later, and we can't possibly get into every single facet of drug testing in tennis. I've got a lot of, you know, hanging out on the sofa to do. But we will get into a few pertinent bits. It's a messy old situation with drug testing. The whole debate was originally sparked by an article in Deadspin last June, or this June, that reported that Serena was drug tested by the US anti-doping agency USADA more frequently in the first half of 2018 than other American tennis players. The problem with that article, though, is that that's not the whole picture, because at any one time, and bear with me here, just take a deep breath, we'll get through this as quickly as you can. At any one time, an athlete is subject to testing by three different organisations: the International Federation of the Sport, so the ITF, the anti-doping agency of the country, so in Serena's case, that's USADA, and the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA. So it is true that Serena was tested more between January and June of this year by USADA than any of her country women. She was tested five times in that period, and Venus Williams and Coco Vandeweghe were only tested twice. Sloane Stephens, Madison Keys tested just once. All five of the top-ranked American male players also tested less frequently than Serena. But those numbers don't account for in-competition or out-of-competition tests administered by WADA or by the ITF. And the latter, the ITF testing, accounts for more than three quarters of all testing of elite tennis players. That's according to Stuart Miller, the manager of the ITF's anti-doping program. So the ITF only publishes its data at the end of the year, so we're not going to know until the end of this year whether the USADA figures match up with ITF figures. Matt suggests that for a more complete comparison, as complete a comparison as we can hope for with this dog's dinner of a situation, we can look at the past 5 years, from 2013 to 2016, which we do have data for. Now, Serena in that period was tested an almost identical number of times as her American peers, as well as top players like Federer, Nadal and Wozniacki. In 2017, she was tested less, but she was on maternity leave for most of that year. So some questions to ask. Why has Serena been tested more by USADA than her peers? One explanation might be that she spent much of the first half of this year, which is the period that we're talking about, or Serena, or the data that was published in Deadspin that prompted Serena to speak out about it in the first place. She was at home in the United States for most of that period, which means that she would have had more out-of-competition USADA testing than players who were on tour outside of the country for that time, because when players are out of the country, it would be the ITF overseeing the out-of-competition tests. And a second explanation is that USADA have what they call an intelligent out-of-competition testing program, which is that they openly only test players more who have sustained success in their sport. And I'm editorialising a bit here, but I rather suspect that's because in large part of what happened to them with Lance Armstrong. You know, USADA were the organisation most heavily involved in the Lance Armstrong scandal. It was a USADA report, I believe, that provided sort of the final nail in his coffin and ended up in him coming clean. And why wouldn't their policy be shaped by what was, you know, the most earth-shattering doping-related incident in the history of sport? So I can understand that. But certainly, it's difficult, isn't it? Over to you, David. What do you think? My feelings are, I just think there needs to be more testing, full stop. I just think doping controls in tennis need to be better. I'm not, you know, if that means testing some players more than others and, you know, whatever, I'm fine with that. Just do whatever you need to do for us to have the strongest possible doping controls that we can.
Well, absolutely. First and foremost, in response to that one, I think that Serena has... feels to me fired off some irritation on social media here without referring to all those other factors that you've outlined in terms of how the system works and the three-part way of testing tennis players in and out of competition and in terms of jurisdictions and territories, etc. Because when you actually go down into the numbers, that there have been some revealed over on Twitter about, yes, she has tested more than some of those compatriots, in fact all of those compatriots in one way, but when you actually look at the numbers across the board, Tamani Karyol, who's one of the journalists on the tour, listed the numbers of times tennis players, US tennis players, have been tested over the years. And Serena Williams is at 41, John Isner is at 42, Venus Williams at 43, Mike Bryan at 43, and Bob Bryan at 56. So he's way more. What he's been doing, I do not know.
I love the idea of the dope testers showing up and going, no, we only want Mike.
Bob. No, we only want Bob.
Off you go, Bob.
Sorry, Mike, we're not interested in you today.
Mike's the one that looks suspicious here.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, to be honest, I get why players get irritated by it. I can understand why Serena Williams, particularly having been out of the game for quite a while and just probably not having thought about it much, because her mind is understandably completely elsewhere. And then it suddenly starts happening a lot. It probably does feel a bit like victimisation. But that's a bit of an irresponsible thing to tweet, in my opinion, if it's not factually absolutely sound, because those are very, very strong emotive words she's used. And I'd like to think that she would, and I've so much respect for her and the way she's spoken on so many issues over the last few years, but I'm a bit concerned about that, because that people listen to every word she says and follow and listen and hang on every word she says, and I'm not convinced that's fair in this case.
Yeah, I mean, look, if it was 6 o'clock in the morning and a drug tester was showing up at my door and asking to draw some of my blood, I'd be blooming irritated as well, David. I'd be an absolute nightmare. But that I wouldn't expect, you know, the wider tennis world to be particularly sympathetic with me. For me, the most pertinent, for all the stats on Serena, the far more pertinent stat is that tennis players get tested significantly less than a lot of other elite level athletes in other sports. Tennis testing isn't at the level of other sports. And stats on that, for me, is where we should be looking, rather than stats on whether Serena is tested more or less than Bob and Mike Bryan. It's not that I'm not sort of vaguely sympathetic with her personal irritation. I just don't think that's of consequence to the wider world, really.
No, and probably, as much as I love aggro, probably best off staying off social media if you're angry.
It's that awkward thing of that's when you most want to take to social media, isn't it? When you're feeling aggro, and that's when you should probably not. Just a few more bits and bobs, David, before we wrap up for another week. Before you bob off on holiday for goodness knows how long.
Get my gaming gear.
So I'm going to rinse the most David Law for as I get.
Oh, I forgot. I'm back next week. I did forget. I've got one more podcast.
I thought you were.
Yes, I have. And then I'm off on holiday.
I have to say, when you said that, I thought, hang on a second. I'm being stood up in advance.
Yeah, because I'm still angling for our rematch next week if I can.
Yeah. So we've got one more week of Law.
Right. Sorry about that, everybody.
Before the good times roll.
And then,
but still, I'll rinse as much Law as I can just for the moment.
Okay.
Pickups on some of the responses we had to the talking points from last week's show, beautifully curated by Melanie Bowes, who, by the way, David, can I mention that I am currently leading Melanie Bowes in the predictions challenge?
Can you mention, or have you just mentioned?
Well, it's happened, hasn't it?
Yeah, just accidentally
slips out. So unless you intervene and ask that to be edited out, which I don't think would be a dignified move.
Editor Patrick, can that go?
anyway... some pole vaults, David, seem to have happened.
Nothing to do with me.
You know, in fact, quite a lot of pole vaults seem to be happening.
Amazing.
As a result of last week. So, Kyle Edmund win a slam? 80% said no. And then on to the Commissioner of Tennis stuff, which is where things really ramped up, not only among us mere mortals, David, but the likes of Paul Annacone, Marty Fish, and Andy Roddick. Got involved.
They all want to be tennis commissioner. Hashtag.
Yeah. They saw Rosie muscling in on the territory. So here are some suggestions and the current voting situation as of 10 a.m. this morning. 69% think there should be a shot clock in tennis. 58% think women should play best of five sets at slams. 71% think fifth set tiebreak should be introduced. 74% think there should be no on-court coaching. 66% think players should have to pick up their own towels. I can't believe that's not 100%. I can't believe 34% of people think it's acceptable for grown adults to toss their sweaty towel in the direction of a child and expect them to pick it up. Like, what is the universe we're living in? 66% of people think the Davis Cup reform proposal should be ditched and the competition left as it is. 75% think the off-season should be extended. 91% think there should be a Masters 1000 on grass. 57% disagree with the idea of best of three first week, best of five second week at slams. I'm disappointed with that number, David. How about you?
That's the most interesting result of all of them, because all of the others have gone...
Not the towel one.
...the way I would have expected.
34% of people think...
Well, I mean, I must say, when I was thinking about that, I was thinking, actually, I wouldn't mind having... I might get my kids to start.
Yeah, there's plenty of things that I would quite like that I definitely should not be ever allowed to do.
It'd be good.
Like throwing my sweaty towel in the direction of a 13-year-old and expecting them to just pick it up for me.
Well, I am surprised that 57% disagreed with the idea of best of three first week, best of five second week. I'm surprised by that. 909 votes as well.
We will do a better selling job on that, David.
Right, we're still
Mark
working on it. We're going to win people over.
We need to get some big names behind us, don't we?
Who?
We need to get some prominent backers for the idea.
Okay.
Mary was up for it, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was up for it.
57% of people are disagreeing with Mary Carrillo.
Oh,
shame on you.
Yeah.
On the subject of quirky head-to-head records, Student Matt has done us an absolute solid here. And
what's that mean
done
again?
what I couldn't do on the spot, which is pick out some of the most beautifully weird head-to-head records in tennis. And my favourite one amongst current players is Thomas Burdick 12 wins to Kevin Anderson's 0.
Yeah.
What's happening there?
That is weird because they are so similar.
Yeah.
I'd have thought that would have been 6 each.
That's so weird. Sybil Bammer is 2-0 against Serena Williams. Martina Vatilova was 33-1 against Zina Garrison.
And that ain't changing.
These are not current head-to-heads. Joe Jury, 4-3 over Steffi Graf. That one definitely ain't changing because Joe Jury is currently recovering from a knee replacement. Get well, Joe. Stefan Edberg, 10-0 against Thomas Muster, including 4-0 on clay. That one's pretty special.
Yeah, I love that.
Stefan Edberg, 4-0 on clay.
Yeah, I always remember that. Thomas just, he could not stand playing him. He just hated it. This bloke who kept coming in every shot.
Richard Gasquet, 8-0 against Gilles Simon. I will put that one down to Frenchness because I think all of the French players among themselves have weird head-to-heads, weird score lines, weird matches. There's something weird going on there. Monica Seles, 20-1 against Conchita Martinez. And Svetlana Peronkova, the Hungarian grass court specialist, is 3-1 against Venus Williams.
Bulgarian. But
Bulgarian, sorry. Yes,
slightly more, sorry. Slightly more recent, though, Venus Williams, isn't it? So I think that one's...
Is it? She beat her once at Wimbledon.
Yeah, I know. I still feel that that's...
A while ago, when it was Venus Williams' peak, I think. Mm. Certainly one of those wins was peak Venus.
Mm.
Hey, she's not that far off her peak.
No.
She's just coming into her prime.
Weird head-to-heads, love them. 1-0, Catherine Whittaker. That's
yeah, we do
weird.
Love them. We do love them. Do we have time for any other business, David, or need it wait?
I think it needs to wait for next week because we need to have stuff to talk about then.
Right, okay. Well, tennis is happening this week, David. Andy Murray is coming back to hardcourt tennis in Washington. As you said, he's drawn Mackenzie McDonald. This is as unscientific as it gets. But, David, on the basis of the increased frequency of his social media activity, I think he's feeling a heck of a lot more bullish about his tennis than he was even 3 weeks ago.
Four weeks ago
when he pulled out of Wimbledon. I think his whole mind state is... completely different.
No, I'd agree with you. When he's active on Instagram, I think he's active of mind and body and feeling chipper generally. So absolutely right. Tennis podcastaways, can we talk about that?
Tennis podcastaways, we can, just after I mentioned the fact that Dominic Thiem is playing on clay in Kitchbull this week, and I'll just let that hang in the air.
Why is that
tennis
news?
He's going to lose first round at the US Open again, isn't he?
He's disproved us, though, because he reached the final of the French Open. So
maybe. Yeah, but he wasn't playing on grass like 3 weeks before the French Open, was he? Anyway, tennis podcastaways, David. Yes, this is a bit of business which cannot possibly wait until next week because we have a winner. Our competition to win a holiday at La Manga Club for two people has closed. And David, myself and student Matt selected the shortlist. We selected two entries apiece for the shortlist.
And there were dozens.
And there were dozens. There really were dozens. We were blown away, honestly. There were dozens from individuals. You know, some people entered many, many times.
I love it.
And Mr. Pat Cash was good enough to choose his winner from that shortlist. And he chose Chris and Olivia Savory. He chose that. Was it on finals day at Wimbledon that he did that? That was the real final.
It was.
And they had a picture of themselves. They were wearing tennis podcast merch, weren't they?
They were.
But they were holding a little baby grow, as small a baby grow as you can imagine, because the baby that will be in that baby grow is not yet in the world. Because they were announcing to us, David, that Olivia is pregnant and that baby will be a tennis podcast listener from the womb.
Awesome.
Which is quite a thought.
Beat that.
So Chris and Olivia will be having a lovely holiday at La Manga Club. And we have two runners up as well. One is Luke Mays, who God loves a trier, Luke. And you, goodness me, you put your heart and soul into Tennis Podcastaways. And we applaud that. He had his photo taken wearing Tennis Podcast merchandise alongside the likes of Bartley, Davenport, Watson and Brody. I should have done that in the opposite order, shouldn't I? And built up to Bartley.
Still a good effort, though, wasn't it?
And our other runner-up, who will also be receiving a free item of Tennis Podcast merchandise, is Ada Pesch, who had a photo of herself listening to the Tennis Podcast in the Zurich Opera House. So,
is that legal? That's one of the reasons she didn't win.
We're cultural, David. We're classy.
Incidentally, Luke deserves to get a T-shirt because he was wearing his long-sleeve sweatshirt in 36 degrees for every photo.
Oh, God, yeah. It was black as well.
Good work, Luke.
Me. Yeah, we need to start producing tennis podcast baseball caps, I think, if we're going to continue having heat waves in this country.
Yeah, well, we're not, so we won't.
Anyway, thank you everyone that entered. Thank you, La Manga Club, for providing the prize. And we hope that Chris and Olivia have a quite wonderful holiday a wonderful and happy life together with their new family. And get that baby listening to the tennis podcast ASAP. Get indoctrinating. So we do have other business, David, but it's going to wait.
It's
going to be a cliffhanger until next week.
Good stuff. Yeah. Good stuff to come.
And we will be back next week. You and I, David, we will be in the flesh, I believe. In the flesh, yes.
Maybe the Putney Exchange.
Maybe even at the Putney Exchange, yes. How wonderful that will be. Yes, we've been the tennis podcast. I thought Skype had cut out for a moment there, but you know, you just had nothing to say
just
to my ramblings.
What can I say?
You're just pondering.
That takes me a while sometimes.
We have been the tennis podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, with Amazon Prime Video UK, for whom I will be presenting coverage of the US Open exclusively in the UK and Ireland. If you want to watch the final Grand Slam of this tennis season, and I think if you're listening to the tennis podcast, you probably do want to watch the last Grand Slam of the tennis season. You can only do so in the UK and Ireland on Amazon Prime Video. So make sure you are subscribed. I will see you then. And what else have we got, David? I'm a bit out of practice.
Melanie
We've got
Bowes.
Our executive producers. Melanie Bowes, Tennis Balls and Triple S, and Charlie the Ferret. And we'll speak to you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.